Thank you for joining us for this episode of Talking with Religious Historians. This is a short-form episode of our regular Ecclesiastical History Society podcast, wherein we talk to established religious historians to find out more about their careers and what advice they would give early career researchers. I'm your host, Dr. Emily Betts, a historian of early modern British medicine and religion. Thank you for joining us today. On today's episode, we welcome Professor Giles Gasper. Professor Gasper is professor of medieval history at Durham University. He specializes in the intellectual history of the High Middle Ages, particularly the development of theology, monastic life, spiritual and material culture, and the history of science in the 11th to 13th centuries. He is currently principal investigator on the Interdisciplinary Ordered Universe Project, which works to edit, translate, and contextualize the scientific works of the 13th century theologian and philosopher Robert Grossetist. Professor Gasper is also a prolific author and has written a number of volumes, including most recently Mapping the Universe, Robert Grossetist's De Sphaera on the Sphere, which came out last year with Oxford University Press. Welcome to the podcast, and thank you so much for joining me today.
Yeah, it's an absolute pleasure. Thank you, Emily.
Great. So just to jump in, I would love to hear more about your research. You look into so many different things. You research so much. So what is exciting you now about your research, and what are you the most excited about going forward?
I mean, a common thread through the things that I've been interested in is working with other people and working collaboratively across different disciplines and across sectors. So actually, right at the moment, I'm putting the final touches on an internal project that we've run at Durham University on heritage and looking at heritage from a radically multidisciplinary perspective. So we've called it Heritage 360 and looking at anything from an object, an artifact to a landscape, but putting in perspectives from natural sciences, from arts and humanities, from the business school and from social sciences and health. So it's sort of linking natural and cultural and intangible and tangible and providing quite a holistic approach to this and including partners and other agencies that are obviously highly involved in the field and taking their challenges. And this, in a sense, is a lineal descendant of the work on Grossetist and the Ordered Universe, because that specifically, again, brought together humanities experts in various fields, theology, classics, and history, with modern scientists who are looking at the phenomena that Grossetist describes there. So that sort of lovely meeting of different disciplinary toolkits is what fascinates me, and applying that in different contexts.
That's great. And you are, like I said in the introduction, you are the principal investigator on this Ordered Universe project. And I would love it if you could just tell the audience a bit more about that.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's in its final stages at the moment. We're on the third volume of five of the HOPFIS main scientific works. These are shorter treatises. The one on the sphere is probably the longest. It's not quite a textbook, but that takes you through astronomy, basically. But these are treatises on natural phenomena, so colour, light, the rainbow, lines and rays, which demonstrate his own capacity. I mean, he's one of the first generation of Latin scholars to really be engaging with the Aristotelian natural philosophical corpus, which is being translated into Latin over the whole of the 12th century. And it's Grossetist and his generation that really get to grips with it. And also the attendant commentaries and other works by Arabic language scholars, so particularly Avicenna and Averroes, to give them their Latin titles, Ibn Sina and Ibn Rushd, as well as other commentaries from Latin writers as well. So it's 13 treatises. They're quite short normally. They deal with a particular topic and they tend to break off quite suddenly. So they might come from a teaching environment. We're not quite sure where he is when he's writing these texts, probably between about 1195 and about 1230. So it's quite an interesting historical exercise as well, to sort of figure out or make a best guess at the order of the treatises. But it's a very interesting exercise in close reading, We went through a period of years generously funded by the Arts and Humanities Council of bringing together, as I said, this widely multidisciplinary group, and literally doing collaborative reading, so word by word, re-editing and retranslating, translation. My colleague Sigbjørn Sønnesen, now at Bristol University, would patiently prepare all the editions and translations and winningly have them debated at quite some length as to whether this meant exactly what it did. But the results are a very rich and interesting range of perspectives that come onto both the historical but also understanding the mechanics of the phenomena that Grosset has just described.
That's fascinating, and that sounds like quite a task, so well done. What is it actually about Robert Grosset himself that drew you to focus on his works? Was there a specific pull there that you had to him?
So, I mean, yes, it's an interesting exercise in serendipity. I was interested in Grosset from quite an early point. In fact, yeah, in my first postdoc position. So my doctoral thesis was on Anselm of Canterbury in comparison of his theology to Greek patristic theology. And of course, Grosset is a great translator, in fact, of John of Damascus in particular. So there was some linkage there. But I was mostly fascinated by his views on light, particularly in the Hexameter and his treatise on the 6 days of creation. But he also, it's one of the next volumes that we're going to be, or one of the next treatises that we're going to be doing, writes a whole treatise on light, which might be called body. And he's kind of exploring the biggest body he can think of, which is the universe. And he has this wonderful phrase that the universe begins from a single point of light expanding instantaneously into the shape of a sphere, which had physics colleagues thinking about the eerie resonance this has with the Big Bang. But Grosset goes on to explore really how in a sense that material universe comes to be. Underlying that is the notion that the universe has to begin in time, because we know it will end in time, and that's in conformity with the biblical and Christian understanding, and in a sense against the Aristotelian notion of the universe without a beginning and without an end. So even within these scientific texts, we can see that the theological underpinnings of his own understanding. So I think the interest was always there. And then I had a chance meeting with a remarkable Provost Chancellor for Research, Tom McLeish, who died very recently. Tom is a physicist, and he'd come to Durham and actually came round departments and their research committees, and we got chatting. He was interested in Grosset because he was interested in the theology science discussions and had been to some seminars at Leeds, where he was before, one of which had featured Grosset and the treatise on light. So we just got talking, and the whole project, in a sense, spooled from there.
That's really great. The coming together of different departments is a very interdisciplinary project. I think, you know, that cannot be underscored enough. And I wanted to ask you, as principal investigator on a project like this, of such a large scale and with so many different people, do you have any advice, not necessarily for a project this size, but for people who want to put their own projects together, who are newer to the field? What have you learned? Give us your wisdom for how to go about, you know, creating a successful project.
You need a lot of very good support and helpers. So, I mean, I had two wonderful co-investigators in Tom McLeish and then Hannah Smithson, who was an experimental psychologist. She was at Durham and moved to Oxford. So having two scientists who had already got the mindset of the bigger projects was enormously helpful. It was a big team as well. I mean, the core group was about 20, and everybody brought their own experience. In total, I think we had about 170 people involved globally, either as participants in workshops, or we would bring in particular people for publications we were doing. So we needed a specialist on rainbows, for example, and one happened to have been working on the British Antarctic Survey, so a contact of Hannah's. So he was brought in for some very specific knowledge there. So it was really fascinating learning different disciplinary expectations, as it were. So keeping an open mind on that one. The preparation time, I mean, we started with small meetings and making applications internally. Then we had a network phase. And then I think we were ready to articulate the bigger idea. So growing it gradually. And we had knockbacks too. You know, you're not going to get every funding application you put in for. So that's part and parcel of the process. I don't actually like the notion of success and failure in that field. It's just a process, and sometimes grants come off and sometimes they don't. So we were very lucky indeed to get the funding for the main project in 2015. But there'd been an awful lot of smaller and medium-sized preparation before then. And that also meant that we had a core group that were interested in talking to each other. And I think that was key to it, as well as having a singular focus on the text. So I think, especially with an interdisciplinary program, having that point of focus was really beneficial.
Nice. And I think that's so important to remind people, because, you know, you spend a lot of your time researching on your own, it seems, especially doing your PhD or, you know, writing. And so to hear the focus being so much on teamwork for these larger projects, I think for a lot of people is like a breath of fresh air that you can actually get out there and talk about what, you know, your research with others. So I love that.
Right. Exactly. And I think it's a big point about the project too, is that it's all ages. So we had undergraduates involved, early career colleagues. It's been really nice to see all of them move into the various things that they've done. Most have got positions, but all the way up to emeritus colleagues. So having that blend of experience and taking ideas from every perspective. We had a very nice little rule that there were no trespassers and no stupid questions. Having those sort of that ethos right from the beginning, that everybody's opinion is as valid as anybody else's, I think was good to set. And then we worked quite hard to broaden where we could. So we had specialists like Nader El Bizri coming in who work on the Arabic tradition. Now, whilst Grosseteste doesn't engage with that in Arabic, obviously he's engaging with the Latin translations. It was important to us to understand where that's coming from, as just as important as it is for us to understand how a rainbow works for when Grosseteste is talking about the rainbow. So trying to broaden it and make it as diverse as possible was actually necessary, I think, to the successful makeup of the team and the program.
Speaking of widening the net, there were many creative aspects to this project. Can you talk about a few of maybe the non-traditional aspects when you think of a research project?
Yeah. So when we did our impact projections, I mean, we were a little bit traditional. We were going to do a public outreach program, which we did, and that was really great. I mean, we worked through things like the Being Human Festival and had these wonderful workshops where we went through these texts with anybody and everybody. It was great fun. And we also ran a widening participation scheme or opened up a Northeast chapter of a wider program, which runs in fact from Oxford, but quite an innovative one in terms of going into schools. We took our project into the schools, so we didn't dumb it down at all, and had some absolutely wonderful responses from the students that took our courses over a period of about 5 years. The creative arts element was completely, again, serendipitous. We weren't anticipating that at all. A number of artists contacted us just because they'd seen the website. So that was an eye-opener in terms of the importance of keeping that profile. A number came to talks that we were doing. My colleague, Brian Tanner, a physicist who I work with quite a lot, working at the moment on 12th century accounts of natural phenomena. But Brian and I were giving a talk at the Royal Society in the Open House series. There was an artist there. She contacted us, Alexandra Carr, started working with the project. And we said that was great. So she did a wonderful series of installations. She's a multimedia sculptor. We got a Levi Hume funded artist in residence for her. She did this absolute beautiful model of the medieval universe. And she's gone on to wonderful things. So she's just completed a massive sculpture in the new gallery at the Science Museum. So if anybody wants to see that, that's where it is. But but it's been exciting to do that. Another one was with the National Glass Centre, well, the University of Sunderland's Glass and Ceramics Department at the NGC. And that, again, was a chance visit, watching the hot glass and seeing colour and the medium of glass and thinking this is exactly like Rossiter's treatise on colour. And in fact, he does relate his treatise on colour to stained glass. But got in touch with a couple of the artists there, Kate Watkinson and Colin Rennie, and they responded within about 5 minutes to say, really keen on a collaboration. And we ran a very similar program of collaborative readings. They got us to come over, and we also tried out making glass and doing that sort of thing. And this spawned a wonderful exhibition of 8 or 9 new pieces, some of which were very large scale, some of which were smaller, but work too with their student to just sort of produce work inspired by this 30th century thinker, which was a wonderful thing.
Right. That is so fun. I mean, just the idea that you can bring somebody like a 13th century bishop into today and have people learn about it and really see the things that he was seeing and talking about. It's just a great way of sharing your research, I think. It's fantastic.
Yeah. And it allows different levels or different ways of accessing the material too. So there's the academic volumes. We did a lot of non-academic publication too. But, you know, having great big pieces of artwork is a different way to bring people in.
Fantastic. And that, I mean, that sounds like a lot in itself, but that's not all you do. You have many different research interests. And I wanted to pick up on one of them. You've got a focus on notions of economy and order in the High Middle Ages. Can you tell us, what does that mean, first off, and what projects have come from that, if any?
Well, in a sense, ordered universe is one of those. I've always been fascinated by the idea of economy, or economia, so the ordering of the household in its original form, but applying that in a Christian sense to the ordering of God's creation. So in a sense, that's also the interest in light. I'm very interested in that Genesis, the first Genesis account, the genre of the hexameron as it moves from the patristic period, or actually quite early, if we think about Philo the Jew, through the Middle Ages. And in a sense, one could see Milton as the last of the hexameral commentaries. So an interesting genre to look at there. So that notion of order, plus in the period that I'm most focused on, the 12th and early 13th centuries, thinking about order is a big principle in terms of establishing theology, or seeing the emergence of theology as a disciplinary area. Obviously, it exists before as an activity and as a faithful service, but it's given a particular inflection and identity in the 12th century, both institutionally, but also in terms of the intellectual forms that it takes. So that's been that one, and an interesting project on thinking about money and the church as well, and that wider thinking about order and economy in a monastic setting. I've been quite interested in that, and how monastic authors flip and move between thinking about spiritual economies and material economies, and how the two are sometimes kept separate or sometimes held together. So that spawned quite a lot of thinking there.
Great. Well, I'm very excited to see what comes next. Please keep us updated at the Ecclesiastical History Society, because we will definitely push any and all of this fun research. There's one final question I always ask everybody at the end of these podcasts, and it is, what is your favorite part of being an academic?
I think the opportunity to do the things we do. So working with the glass artists and sculptors is one thing. We also worked with light and sound experts at the projection studio, Ross Ashton and Karen Monnet. And they worked out that we've done about 8 collaborations with them. So this is seeing your work projected onto buildings, and from Durham Lumiere to the Berlin Light Festival and the Napa Festival in California. A lot of that was Grosseteste related. Some of it more recently has been more historical. But seeing your work and being able to stand in the crowd and just see some of the results of what you and a team and working with others can produce is just an amazing feeling. And that notion of transforming, the transformative work of humanities, is quite humbling, actually.
Oh, it sounds so rewarding and really, really wonderful. And you are putting out a lot of great outputs right now. And so I just thank you so much for taking the time to come on and talk to us about it, and to also give some advice to our listeners who are just starting out on their history journey. Thank you so much, Professor Gasper.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.